While people are reading that span, they detect extraneous signals, like a blip flashed on the screen, more slowly, and have more trouble keeping a list of extra words in memory. Even their EEGs, electroencephalograms, or records of the brain's electrical activity, show the effects of the strain. Then, at the point at which the trace is discovered and the memory store can be emptied, the dumped phrase makes an appearance on the mental stage that can be detected in several ways. If an experimenter flashes a word from the moved phrase, for example, boy, at that point, people recognize it more quickly. They also recognize words related to the moved phrase, say, girl, more quickly. The effect is strong enough to be visible in brain waves. If interpreting the trace results in an implausible interpretation, as in, which food did the children read, trace, in class? The EEGs show a boggle reaction at the point of the trace. Connecting phrases with traces is a hairy computational operation. The parser, while holding the phrase in mind, must constantly be checking for the trace, an invisible and inaudible little nothing. There is no way of predicting how far down in the sentence the trace will appear, and sometimes it can be quite far down. The girl wondered who. John believed that Mary claimed that the baby saw trace. And until it is found, the semantic role of the phrase is a wild card, especially now that the who-whom distinction is going the way of the phonograph record. I wonder who trace introduced John to Marcia. Who equals the introducer? I wonder who Bruce introduced Trace to Marcia. Who equals the one being introduced? I wonder who Bruce introduced John to Trace. Who equals the target of the introduction? This problem is so tough that good writers and even the grammar of the language itself take steps to make it easier. One principle for good style is to minimize the amount of intervening sentence in which a moved phrase must be held in memory. This is a task that the English passive construction is good for, notwithstanding the recommendations of computerized style checkers to avoid it across the board. In the following pair of sentences, the passive version is easier because the memory taxing region before the trace is shorter. Reverse the clamp that the stainless steel hex head bolt extending upward from the seat post yoke holds, trace, in place. Reverse the clamp that trace is held in place by the stainless steel hex head bolt extending upward from the seat post yoke. And universally, grammars restrict the amount of a tree that a phrase can move across. For example, one can say, that's the guy that you heard the rumor about, trace. But the following sentence is quite odd. That's the guy that you heard the rumor that Mary likes, trace. Languages have bounding restrictions that turn some phrases, like the complex noun phrase, the rumor that Mary likes him, into islands from which no words can escape. This is a boon to listeners because the parser, knowing that the speaker could not have moved something out of such a phrase, can get away with not monitoring it for a trace. But the boon to listeners exerts a cost on speakers. For these sentences, they have to resort to a clumsy extra pronoun, as in, that's the guy that you heard the rumor that Mary likes him. Parsing, for all its importance, is only the first step in understanding a sentence. Imagine parsing the following real-life dialogue. P. The grand jury thing has its, a view of this. They might, suppose we have a grand jury proceeding. What would that do to the Irvin thing? Would it go right ahead anyway? Probably. But then on that score, though, we have, let me just run by that you do that on a grand jury. We could then have a much better cause in terms of saying, look, This is a grand jury in which, the prosecutor. How about a special prosecutor? We could use Peterson or use another one. You see, he is probably suspect. Would you call in another prosecutor? D. I'd like to have Peterson on our side advising us. Laughs. Frankly. P. Frankly. Well, Peterson is honest. Is anybody about to be question him? Are they? D. No, no. But he'll get a barrage when, these Watergate hearings start. P. Yes, but he can go up and say that he's been told to go further in the grand jury, and to go into this and that and the other thing. Call everybody in the White House. I want them to come. I want the, to go to the grand jury. D. This may result. This may happen even without our calling for it when these, P. Vesco. D. No. Well, that's one possibility. But also, when these people go back before the grand jury here, they are going to pull all these criminal defendants back in before the grand jury and immunize them. P. And immunize them. Why? Who? Are you going to... On what? D. The U.S. Attorney's Office will. P. To do what? D. To talk about anything further they want to talk about. P. Yeah. What do they gain out of it? D. Nothing? P. To hell with them. D. They're going to stonewall it, as it now stands, except for Hunt. That's the leverage in his threat. H. This is Hunt's opportunity. P. That's why... H. God, if he can lay this... P. That's why you're... For your immediate thing, you've got no choice with Hunt but the 120 or whatever it is, right? D. That's right. P. Will you agree that that's a buy-time thing? You better damn well get that done, but fast. D. I think he ought to be given some signal, anyway, to... P. Expletive deleted. Get it in a way that, who's going to talk to him? Coulson? He's the one who's supposed to know him. D. Well, Coulson doesn't have any money, though. That's the thing. That's been one of the real problems. They have, been unable to raise any money. $1 million in cash, or the like, has been just a very difficult problem, as we've discussed before. Apparently, Mitchell talked to Pappas, and I called him last... John asked me to call him last night after our discussion, and after you'd met with John to see where that was. And I said, have you talked to Pappas? He was at home, and Martha picked up the phone, so it was all in code. Did you talk to the Greek? And he said, yes, I have. And I said, is the Greek bearing gifts? He said, well, I want to call you tomorrow on that. P. Well, look, what is it that you need on that, now look, unintelligible, I am, unfamiliar with the money situation. This dialogue took place on March 17, 1973, among President Richard Nixon, P., his counsel, John W. Dean III, D., and his chief of staff, H.R. Haldeman, H. Howard Hunt, working for Nixon's re-election campaign in June 1972, had directed a break-in at the Democratic Party headquarters in the Watergate building, in which his men bugged the telephones of the party chairman and other workers. Several investigations were underway to determine if the operation had been ordered from the White House by Haldeman or Attorney General John Mitchell. The men were discussing whether to pay $120,000 in hush money to Hunt before he testified before a grand jury. We have this verbatim dialogue because in 1970, Nixon, claiming to be acting on behalf of future historians, bugged his own office and began secretly taping all his conversations. In February 1974, the Judiciary Committee of the House of Representatives subpoenaed the tapes to help them determine whether Nixon should be impeached. This excerpt is from their transcription. Largely on the basis of this passage, the committee recommended impeachment. Nixon resigned in August 1974. The Watergate tapes are the most famous and extensive transcripts of real-life speech ever published. When they were released, Americans were shocked, though not all for the same reason. Some people, a very small number, were surprised that Nixon had taken part in a conspiracy to obstruct justice. A few were surprised that the leader of the free world cussed like a stevedore. But one thing that surprised everyone was what ordinary conversation looks like when it is written down verbatim. Conversation out of context is virtually opaque. Part of the problem comes from the circumstances of transcription. The intonation and timing that delineate phrases is lost, and the transcription from anything but the highest fidelity tape is unreliable. Indeed, in the White House's independent transcription of this low-quality recording, many puzzling passages are rendered more sensibly. For example, "I want the, to go" is transcribed as "I want them, to go." But even when transcribed perfectly, conversation is hard to interpret. People often speak in fragments, interrupting themselves in mid-sentence to reformulate the thought or change the subject. It's often unclear who or what is being talked about because conversers use pronouns. Him, them, this, that, we, they, it, one. Generic words. Do, happen, the thing, the situation, that score, these people, whatever. And ellipses. The U.S. Attorney's Office will, and that's why. Intentions are expressed indirectly. In this episode, whether a man would end the year as President of the United States or as a convicted criminal literally hinged on the meaning of get it, and on whether what is it that you need was meant as a request for information or as an implicit offer to provide something. Not everyone was shocked by the unintelligibility of transcribed speech. Journalists know all about it, and it is a routine practice to edit quotations and interviews heavily before they are published. For many years, the temperamental Boston Red Sox pitcher Roger Clemens complained bitterly that the press misquoted him. The Boston Herald, in what they must have known was a cruel trick, responded by running a daily feature in which his post-game comments were reproduced word for word. Journalists' editing of conversations became a legal issue in 1983, when the writer Janet Malcolm published an unflattering New Yorker series about the psychoanalyst Jeffrey Masson. Masson had written a book accusing Freud of dishonesty and cowardice in retracting his observation that neurosis is caused by sexual abuse in childhood, and was fired as the curator of the Freud archives in London. According to Malcolm, Masson described himself in her interviews as an intellectual gigolo, and, after Freud, the greatest analyst who's ever lived, and is planning to turn Anna Freud's house after her death into a place of sex, women, and fun. Masson sued Malcolm and the New Yorker for $10 million, claiming that he had never said these things and that other quotations had been altered to make him look ridiculous. Though Malcolm could not document the quotations from her tapes and handwritten notes, she denied having manufactured them, and her lawyers argued that even if she had, they were a rational interpretation of what Masson had said. Doctored quotes, they argued, are standard journalistic practice and are not examples of printing something with knowledge that it is false or with reckless disregard for whether it is false, part of the definition of libel. Several courts threw out the case on First Amendment grounds, but in June 1991, the Supreme Court unanimously reinstated it. In a closely watched opinion, the majority defined a middle ground for journalists' treatment of quotations. Requiring them to publish quotes verbatim was not even considered. Justice Kennedy, writing for the majority, said that the deliberate alteration of the words uttered by a plaintiff does not equate with knowledge of falsity, and that if an author alters a speaker's words but effects no material change in meaning, the speaker suffers no injury to reputation. We may reject any special test of falsity for quotations, including one which would draw the line at correction of grammar or syntax. If the Supreme Court had asked me, I would have sided with Justices White and Scalia in calling for some such line to be drawn. Like many linguists, I doubt that it is possible to alter a speaker's words, including most grammar and syntax, without materially changing the meaning. These incidents show that real speech is very far from "the dog likes ice cream," and that there is much more to understanding a sentence than parsing it. Comprehension uses the semantic information recovered from a tree as just one premise in a complex chain of inference to the speaker's intentions. Why is this so? Why is it that even honest speakers rarely articulate the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth? The first reason is airtime. Conversation would bog down if one had to refer to the United States Senate Select Committee on the Watergate break-in and related sabotage efforts by uttering that full description every time. Once alluded to, the Irvin thing, or just it, will suffice. For the same reason, it is wasteful to spell out the following chain of logic. Hunt knows who gave him the orders to organize the Watergate break-in. The person who gave him the orders might be part of our administration. If the person is in our administration and his identity becomes public, the entire administration will suffer. Hunt has an incentive to reveal the identity of the person who gave him the orders because it might reduce his prison sentence. Some people will take risks if they are given enough money. Therefore, Hunt may conceal the identity of his superior if he is given enough money. There is reason to believe that approximately $120,000 would be a large enough incentive for Hunt to conceal the identity of the person who gave him the order. Hunt could accept that money now, but it is in his interest to continue to blackmail us in the future. Nonetheless, it might be sufficient for us to keep him quiet in the short run, because the press and the public might lose interest in the Watergate scandal in the months to come, and if he reveals the identity later, the consequences for our administration would not be as negative. Therefore, the self-interested course of action for us is to pay Hunt the amount of money that would be a large enough incentive for him to keep silent until such time as public interest in Watergate wanes. It is more efficient to say, for your immediate thing, you've got no choice with Hunt but the 120 or whatever it is. The efficiency, though, depends on the participants sharing a lot of background knowledge about the events and about the psychology of human behavior. They must use this knowledge to cross-reference the names, pronouns, and descriptions with a single cast of characters and to fill in the logical steps that connect each sentence with the next. If background assumptions are not shared, for example, if one's conversational partner is from a very different culture, or is schizophrenic, or is a machine, then the best parsing in the world will fail to deliver the full meaning of a sentence. Some computer scientists have tried to equip programs with little scripts of stereotyped settings like restaurants and birthday parties to help their programs fill in the missing parts of texts while understanding them. Another team is trying to teach a computer the basics of human common sense, which they estimate to comprise about 10 million facts. To see how formidable the task is, consider how much knowledge about human behavior must be interpolated to understand what he means in a simple dialogue like this. Woman, I'm leaving you. Man, who is he? Understanding, then, requires ingratiating the fragments gleaned from a sentence into a vast mental database. For that to work, speakers cannot just toss one fact after another into a listener's head. Knowledge is not like a list of facts in a trivia column, but is organized into a complex network. When a series of facts comes in succession, as in a dialogue or text, the language must be structured so that the listener can place each fact into an existing framework. Thus, information about the old, the given, the understood, the topic, should go early in the sentence, usually as the subject, and information about the new, the focus, the comment, should go at the end. Putting the topic early in the sentence is another function of the maligned passive construction. In his book on style, Williams notes that the usual advice, avoid passives, should be flouted when the topic being discussed has the role connected with the deep structure object of the verb. For example, read the following two-sentence discussion. Some astonishing questions about the nature of the universe have been raised by scientists studying the nature of black holes in space. The collapse of a dead star into a point perhaps no larger than a marble creates a black hole. The second sentence feels like a non sequitur. It is much better to put it in the passive voice. Some astonishing questions about the nature of the universe have been raised by scientists studying the nature of black holes in space. A black hole is created by the collapse of a dead star into a point perhaps no larger than a marble. The second sentence now fits in smoothly, because its subject, a black hole, is the topic, and its predicate adds new information to that topic. In an extended conversation or essay, a good writer or speaker will make the focus of one sentence the topic of the next one, linking propositions into an orderly train. The study of how sentences are woven into a discourse and interpreted in context, sometimes called pragmatics, has made an interesting discovery, first pointed out by the philosopher Paul Grice and recently refined by the anthropologist Dan Sperber and the linguist Deirdre Wilson. The act of communicating relies on a mutual expectation of cooperation between speaker and listener. The speaker, having made a claim on the precious ear of the listener, implicitly guarantees that the information to be conveyed is relevant, that it is not already known, and that it is sufficiently connected to what the listener is thinking that he or she can make inferences to new conclusions with little extra mental effort. Thus, listeners tacitly expect speakers to be informative, truthful, relevant, clear, unambiguous, brief, and orderly. These expectations help to winnow out the inappropriate readings of an ambiguous sentence, to piece together fractured utterances, to excuse slips of the tongue, to guess the reference of pronouns and descriptions, and to fill in the missing steps of an argument. When a receiver of a message is not cooperative but adversarial, all of this missing information must be stated explicitly, which is why we have the tortuous language of legal contracts with their party of the first part and all rights under said copyright and all renewals thereof subject to the terms of this agreement. The interesting discovery is that the maxims of relevant conversation are often observed in the breach. Speakers deliberately flout them in the literal content of their speech so that listeners can interpolate assumptions that would restore the conversation to relevance. Those assumptions then serve as the real message. A familiar example is the following kind of letter of recommendation. Dear Professor Pinker, I am very pleased to be able to recommend Irving Smith to you. Mr. Smith is a model student. He dresses well and is extremely punctual. I have known Mr. Smith for 3 years now, and in every way I have found him to be most cooperative. His wife is charming. Sincerely, John Jones, Professor. Though the letter contains nothing but positive, factual statements, it guarantees that Mr. Smith will not get the position he is seeking. The letter contains no information relevant to the reader's needs, and thereby violates the maxim that speakers be informative. The reader works on the tacit assumption that the communicative act as a whole is relevant, even if the content of the letter itself is not. So he infers a premise that, together with the letter, makes the act relevant, that the writer has no relevant positive information to convey. Why does the writer demand this minuet, rather than just saying, "Stay away from Smith, he's dumb as a tree"? It is because of another premise that the reader can interpolate. The writer is the kind of person who does not casually injure those who put their trust in him. It is natural that people exploit the expectations necessary for successful conversation as a way of slipping their real intentions into covert layers of meaning. Human communication is not just a transfer of information like two fax machines connected with a wire. It is a series of alternating displays of behavior by sensitive, scheming, second-guessing social animals. When we put words into people's ears, we are impinging on them and revealing our own intentions, honorable or not, just as surely as if we were touching them. Nowhere is this more apparent than in the convoluted departures from plain speaking found in every society that are called politeness. Taken literally, the statement, "I was wondering if you would be able to drive me to the airport," is a prolix string of incongruities. Why notify me of the contents of your ruminations? Why are you pondering my competence to drive you to the airport, and under which hypothetical circumstances? Of course, the real intent, "drive me to the airport," is easily inferred, but because it was never stated, I have an out. Neither of us has to live with the face-threatening consequences of your issuing a command that presupposes you could coerce my compliance. Intentional violations of the unstated norms of conversation are also the trigger for many of the less pedestrian forms of non-literal language, such as irony, humor, metaphor, sarcasm, put-downs, ripostes, rhetoric, persuasion, and poetry. Metaphor and humor are useful ways to summarize the two mental performances that go into understanding a sentence. Most of our everyday expressions about language use a conduit metaphor that captures the parsing process. In this metaphor, ideas are objects, sentences are containers, and communication is sending. We gather our ideas to put them into words. And if our verbiage is not empty or hollow, we might convey or get these ideas across to a listener who can unpack our words to extract their content. But as we have seen, the metaphor is misleading. The complete process of understanding is better characterized by the joke about the two psychoanalysts who meet on the street. One says, "Good morning." The other thinks, "I wonder what he meant by that." Chapter 8. The Tower of Babel. And the whole earth was of one language and of one speech. And it came to pass, as they journeyed from the east, that they found a plain in the land of Shinar, and they dwelt there. And they said to one another, "Go to, let us make brick and burn them thoroughly." And they had brick for stone, and slime they had for mortar. And they said, "Go to, let us build us a city and a tower, whose top may reach unto heaven. And let us make us a name, lest we be scattered abroad upon the face of the whole earth." And the Lord came down to see the city and the tower, which the children of men builded. And the Lord said, "Behold, the people is one, and they have all one language, and this they begin to do. And now nothing will be restrained from them, which they have imagined to do. Go to, let us go down and there confound their language, that they may not understand one another's speech." So the Lord scattered them abroad from thence upon the face of all the earth, and they left off to build the city. Therefore is the name of it called Babel, because the Lord did there confound the language of all the earth, and from thence did the Lord scatter them abroad upon the face of all the earth. Genesis chapter 11, verses 1 through 9. In the year of our Lord 1957, the linguist Martin Use reviewed the preceding three decades of research in linguistics and concluded that God had actually gone much farther in confounding the language of Noah's descendants. Whereas the God of Genesis was said to be content with mere mutual unintelligibility, Use declared that languages could differ from each other without limit and in unpredictable ways. That same year, the Chomskyan Revolution began with the publication of Syntactic Structures, and the next three decades took us back to the literal biblical account. According to Chomsky, a visiting Martian scientist would surely conclude that aside from their mutually unintelligible vocabularies, Earthlings speak a single language. Even by the standards of theological debates, these interpretations are strikingly different. Where did they come from? The 4,000 to 6,000 languages of the planet do look impressively different from English and from one another. Here are the most conspicuous ways in which languages can differ from what we are used to in English. 1. English is an isolating language, which builds sentences by rearranging immutable word-sized units, like dog bites man and man bites dog. Other languages express who did what to whom by modifying nouns with case affixes or by modifying the verb with affixes that agree with its role players in number, gender, and person. One example is Latin, an inflecting language in which each affix contains several pieces of information. Another is Kavunjo, an agglutinating language in which each affix conveys one piece of information and many affixes are strung together, as in the eight-part verb in chapter 5. 2. English is a fixed word order language, where each phrase has a fixed position. Free word order languages allow phrase order to vary. In an extreme case like the Australian Aboriginal language Walpiri, words from different phrases can be scrambled together. This man speared a kangaroo can be expressed as man this kangaroo speared, man kangaroo speared this, and any of the other four orders, all completely synonymous. 3. English is an accusative language, where the subject of an intransitive verb like she in she ran is treated identically to the subject of a transitive verb, like she in she kissed Larry, and different from the object of the transitive verb, like her in Larry kissed her. Ergative languages like Basque and many Australian languages have a different scheme for collapsing these three roles. The subject of an intransitive verb and the object of a transitive verb are identical, and the subject of the transitive is the one that behaves differently. It is as if we were to say, ran her to mean she ran. 4. English is a subject-prominent language in which all sentences must have a subject, even if there is nothing for the subject to refer to, as in, it is raining, or there is a unicorn in the garden. In topic-prominent languages like Japanese, sentences have a special position that is filled by the current topic of the conversation, as in, this place, planting wheat is good, or California, climate is good. 5. English is an SVO language, with the order subject-verb-object, dog bites man. Japanese is subject-object-verb, SOV, dog-man bites. Modern Irish, Gaelic, is verb-subject-object, VSO, bites dog-man. In English, a noun can name a thing in any construction. A banana, two bananas, any banana, all the bananas. In classifier languages, nouns fall into gender classes like human, animal, inanimate, one-dimensional, two-dimensional, cluster, tool, food, and so on. In many constructions, the name for the class, not the noun itself, must be used. For example, three hammers would be referred to as three tools, to wit, hammer. And, of course, A glance at a grammar for any particular language will reveal dozens or hundreds of idiosyncrasies. On the other hand, one can also hear striking universals through the babble. In 1963, the linguist Joseph Greenberg examined a sample of 30 far-flung languages from 5 continents, including Serbian, Italian, Basque, Finnish, Swahili, Nubian, Maasai, Berber, Turkish, Hebrew, Hindi, Japanese, Burmese, Malay, Maori, Mayan, and Quechua, a descendant of the language of the Incas. Greenberg was not working in the Chomskyan school. He just wanted to see if any interesting properties of grammar could be found in all these languages. In his first investigation, which focused on the order of words and morphemes, he found no fewer than 45 universals. Since then, many other surveys have been conducted involving scores of languages from every part of the world, and literally hundreds of universal patterns have been documented. Some hold absolutely. For example, no language forms questions by reversing the order of words within a sentence like, "Built Jack that house in the this is?" Some are statistical. Subjects normally precede objects in almost all languages, and verbs and their objects tend to be adjacent. Thus, most languages have SVO or SOV order. Fewer have VSO. VOS and OVS are rare, less than 1%, and OSV may be non-existent. There are a few candidates, but not all linguists agree that they are OSV. The largest number of universals involve implications. If a language has X, it will also have Y. We came across a typical example of an implicational universal in Chapter 4. If the basic order of a language is SOV, it will usually have question words at the end of the sentence and postpositions. If it is SVO, it will have question words at the beginning and prepositions. Universal implications are found in all aspects of language, from phonology. For instance, if a language has nasal vowels, it will have non-nasal vowels, to word meanings. If a language has a word for purple, it will have a word for red. If a language has a word for leg, it will have a word for arm. If lists of universals show that languages do not vary freely, do they imply that languages are restricted by the structure of the brain? Not directly. First, one must rule out 2 alternative explanations. One possibility is that language originated only once, and all existing languages are the descendants of that proto-language and retain some of its features. These features would be similar across the languages for the same reason that alphabetical order is similar across the Hebrew, Greek, Roman, and Cyrillic alphabets. There is nothing special about alphabetical order. It was just the order that the Canaanites invented, and all Western alphabets came from theirs. No linguist accepts this as an explanation for language universals. For one thing, there can be radical breaks in language transmission across the generations, the most extreme being creolization. But universals hold all of languages, including creoles. Moreover, simple logic shows that a universal implication like, if a language has SVO order, then it has prepositions, but if it has SOV order, then it has postpositions, cannot be transmitted from parent to child the way words are. An implication by its very logic is not a fact about English. Children could learn that English is SVO and has prepositions, but nothing could show them that if a language is SVO, then it must have prepositions. A universal implication is a fact about all languages, visible only from the vantage point of a comparative linguist. If a language changes from SOV to SVO over the course of history, and its postpositions flip to prepositions, there has to be some explanation of what keeps these two developments in sync. Also, if universals were simply what is passed down through the generations, we would expect that the major differences between kinds of language should correlate with the branches of the linguistic family tree, just as the difference between 2 cultures generally correlates with how long ago they separated. As humanity's original language differentiated over time, Some branches might become SOV and others SVO. Within each of these branches, some might have agglutinated words, others isolated words. But this is not so. Beyond a time depth of about 1,000 years, history and typology often do not correlate well at all. Languages can change from grammatical type to type relatively quickly, and can cycle among a few types over and over. Aside from vocabulary, they do not progressively differentiate and diverge. For example, English has changed from a free word order, highly inflected, topic-prominent language, as its sister German remains to this day, to a fixed word order, poorly inflected, subject-prominent language, all in less than a millennium. Many language families contain close to the full gamut of variations seen across the world in particular aspects of grammar. The absence of a strong correlation between the grammatical properties of languages and their place in the family tree of languages suggests that language universals are not just the properties that happen to have survived from the hypothetical mother of all languages. The second counter-explanation that one must rule out before attributing a universal of language to a universal language instinct is that languages might reflect universals of thought or of mental information processing that are not specific to language. As we saw in Chapter 3, universals of color vocabulary probably come from universals of color vision. Perhaps subjects precede objects because the subject of an action verb denotes the causal agent, as in dog bites man. Putting the subject first mirrors the cause coming before the effect. Perhaps head-first or head-last ordering is consistent across all the phrases in a language because it enforces a consistent branching direction, right or left, in the language's phrase structure trees, avoiding difficult-to-understand onion constructions. For example, Japanese is SOV and has modifiers to the left. This gives it constructions like modifier SOV, with the modifier on the outside rather than S modifier OV, with the modifier embedded inside. But these functional explanations are often tenuous, and for many universals they do not work at all. For example, Greenberg noted that if a language has both derivational suffixes, which create new words from old ones, and inflectional suffixes, which modify a word to fit its role in the sentence, then the derivational suffixes are always closer to the stem than the inflectional ones. In Chapter 5, we saw this principle in English in the difference between the grammatical Darwinisms and the ungrammatical Darwinsism. It is hard to think of how this law could be a consequence of any universal principle of thought or memory. Why would the concept of two ideologies based on one Darwin be thinkable, but the concept of one ideology based on two Darwins, say Charles and Erasmus, not be thinkable, unless one reasons in a circle and declares that the mind must find ism to be more cognitively basic than the plural because that's the order we see in language. And remember Peter Gordon's experiments showing that children say mice-eater but never rats-eater, despite the conceptual similarity of rats and mice, and despite the absence of either kind of compound in parents' speech? His results corroborate the suggestion that this particular universal is caused by the way that morphological rules are computed in the brain, with inflection applying to the products of derivation, but not vice versa. In any case, Greenbergerisms are not the best place to look for a neurologically given universal grammar that existed before Babel. It is the organization of grammar as a whole, not some laundry list of facts, that we should be looking at. Arguing about the possible causes of something like SVO order misses the forest for the trees. What is most striking of all is that we can look at a randomly picked language and find things that can sensibly be called subjects, objects, and verbs to begin with. After all, if we were asked to look for the order of subject, object, and verb in musical notation, or in the computer programming language Fortran, or in Morse code, or in arithmetic, we would protest that the very idea is nonsensical. It would be like assembling a representative collection of the world's cultures from the 6 continents and trying to survey the colors of their hockey team jerseys or the form of their harikiri rituals. We should be impressed, first and foremost, that research on universals of grammar is even possible. When linguists claim to find the same kinds of linguistic gadgets in language after language, it is not just because they expect languages to have subjects, and so they label as a subject the first kind of phrase they see that resembles an English subject. Rather, if a linguist examining a language for the first time calls a phrase a subject, using one criterion based on English subjects, say, denoting the agent role of action verbs, the linguist soon discovers that other criteria, like agreeing with the verb in person and number, and occurring before the object, will be true of that phrase as well. It is these correlations among the properties of a linguistic thingamabob across languages that make it scientifically meaningful to talk about subjects and objects and nouns and verbs and auxiliaries and inflections, and not just word class number 2783 and word class number 1491 in languages from Abaza to Zirian. Chomsky's claim that from a Martian's eye view, all humans speak a single language is based on the discovery that the same symbol-manipulating machinery, without exception, underlies the world's languages. Linguists have long known that the basic design features of language are found everywhere. Many were documented in 1960 by the non-Chomskyan linguist C.F. Hockett in a comparison between human languages and animal communication systems. Hockett was not acquainted with Martian. Languages use the mouth-to-ear channel as long as the users have intact hearing. Manual and facial gestures, of course, are the substitute channel used by the deaf. A common grammatical code, neutral between production and comprehension, allows speakers to produce any linguistic message they can understand and vice versa. Words have stable meanings, linked to them by arbitrary convention. Speech sounds are treated discontinuously. A sound that is acoustically halfway between bat and pat does not mean something halfway between batting and patting. Languages can convey meanings that are abstract and remote in time or space from the speaker. Linguistic forms are infinite in number because they are created by a discrete combinatorial system. Languages all show a duality of patterning in which one rule system is used to order phonemes within morphemes, independent of meaning, and another is used to order morphemes within words and phrases, specifying their meaning. Chomskyan linguistics, in combination with Greenbergian surveys, allows us to go well beyond this basic spec sheet. It is safe to say that the grammatical machinery we used for English in chapters 4 through 6 is used in all the world's languages. All languages have a vocabulary in the thousands or tens of thousands, sorted into parts of speech categories, including noun and verb. Words are organized into phrases according to the X-bar system. Nouns are found inside N-bars, which are found inside noun phrases, and so on. The higher levels of phrase structure include auxiliaries, infl, which signify tense, modality, aspect, and negation. Nouns are marked for case and assigned semantic roles by the mental dictionary entry of the verb or other predicate. Phrases can be moved from their deep structure positions, leaving a gap or trace by a structure-dependent movement rule, thereby forming questions, relative clauses, passives, and other widespread constructions. New word structures can be created and modified by derivational and inflectional rules. Inflectional rules primarily mark nouns for case and number, and mark verbs for tense, aspect, mood, voice, negation, and agreement with subjects and objects in number, gender, and person. The phonological forms of words are defined by metrical and syllable trees and separate tiers of features like voicing, tone, and manner, and place of articulation, and are subsequently adjusted by ordered phonological rules. Though many of these arrangements are in some sense useful, their details, found in language after language, but not in any artificial system like Fortran or musical notation, give a strong impression that a universal grammar, not reducible to history or cognition, underlies the human language instinct. God did not have to do much to confound the language of Noah's descendants. In addition to vocabulary, whether the word for mouse is mouse or suris, a few properties of language are simply not specified in universal grammar and can vary as parameters. For example, it is up to each language to choose whether the order of elements within a phrase is head first or head last. Eat sushi and to Chicago versus sushi eat and Chicago to, and whether a subject is mandatory in all sentences or can be omitted when the speaker desires. Furthermore, a particular grammatical widget often does a great deal of important work in one language and hums away unobtrusively in the corner of another. The overall impression is that universal grammar is like an archetypal body plan found across vast numbers of animals in a phylum. For example, among all the amphibians, reptiles, birds, and mammals, there is a common body architecture with a segmented backbone, four jointed limbs, a tail, a skull, and so on. The various parts can be grotesquely distorted or stunted across animals. A bat's wing is a hand, a horse trots on its middle toes, whales' forelimbs have become flippers and their hind limbs have shrunken to invisible nubs, and the tiny hammer, anvil, and stirrup of the mammalian middle ear are jaw parts of reptiles. But from newts to elephants, a common topology of the body plan, the shin bone connected to the thigh bone connected to the hip bone, can be discerned. Many of the differences are caused by minor variations in the relative timing and rate of growth of the parts during embryonic development. Differences among languages are similar. There seems to be a common plan of syntactic, morphological, and phonological rules and principles, with a small set of varying parameters, like a checklist of options. Once set, a parameter can have far-reaching changes on the superficial appearance of the language. If there is a single plan just beneath the surfaces of the world's languages, then any basic property of one language should be found in all the others. Let's re-examine the six supposedly un-English language traits that opened the chapter. A closer look shows that all of them can be found right here in English, and that the supposedly distinctive traits of English can be found in the other languages. 1. English, like the inflecting languages it supposedly differs from, has an agreement marker, the third-person singular S, in he walks. It also has case distinctions in the pronouns, such as he versus him. And like agglutinating languages, it has machinery that can glue many bits together into a long word, like the derivational rules and affixes that create sensationalization and Darwinianisms. Chinese is supposed to be an even more extreme example of an isolating language than English, but it too contains rules that create multi-part words such as compounds and derivatives. 2. English, like free word order languages, has free ordering in strings of prepositional phrases, where each preposition marks the semantic role of its noun phrase, as if it were a case marker. The package was sent from Chicago to Boston by Mary. The package was sent by Mary to Boston from Chicago. The package was sent to Boston from Chicago by Mary, and so on. Conversely, in so-called scrambling languages at the other extreme, like Walpiri, word order is never completely free. Auxiliaries, for example, must go in the second position in a sentence, which is rather like their positioning in English. 3. English, like ergative languages, marks a similarity between the objects of transitive verbs and the subjects of intransitive verbs. Just compare John broke the glass equals object, with the glass broke, glass equals subject of intransitive, or three men arrived with there arrived three men. 4. English, like topic prominent languages, has a topic constituent in constructions like as for fish, I eat salmon, and John, I never really liked. 5. Like SOV languages, not too long ago English availed itself of an SOV order, which is still interpretable in archaic expressions like "till death do us part" and "with this ring I thee wed." 6. Like classifier languages, English insists upon classifiers for many nouns. You can't refer to a single square as a paper, but must say a sheet of paper. Similarly, English speakers say a piece of fruit, which refers to an apple, not a piece of an apple, a blade of grass, a stick of wood, 50 head of cattle, and so on. If a Martian scientist concludes that humans speak a single language, that scientist might well wonder why Earthspeak has those thousands of mutually unintelligible dialects, assuming that the Martian has not read Genesis 11. Perhaps Mars is beyond the reach of the Gideon Society. If the basic plan of language is innate and fixed across the species, why not the whole banana? Why the head-first parameter, the different-sized color vocabularies, the Boston accent? Terrestrial scientists have no conclusive answer. The theoretical physicist Freeman Dyson proposed that linguistic diversity is here for a reason. It was nature's way to make it possible for us to evolve rapidly, by creating isolated ethnic groups in which undiluted biological and cultural evolution can proceed swiftly. But Dyson's evolutionary reasoning is defective. Lacking foresight, languages try to be the best that they can be now. They do not initiate change for change's sake on the chance that one of the changes might come in handy in some ice age 10,000 years in the future. Dyson is not the first to ascribe a purpose to linguistic diversity. A Colombian Bará Indian, a member of an outbreeding set of tribes, when asked by a linguist why there were so many languages, explained, "If we were all Tucano speakers, where would we get our women?" As a native of Quebec, I can testify that differences in language lead to differences in ethnic identification, with widespread effects, good and bad. But the suggestions of Dyson and the Bará put the causal arrow backwards. Surely head-first parameters and all the rest represent massive overkill in some design to distinguish among ethnic groups, assuming that that was even evolutionarily desirable. Humans are ingenious at sniffing out minor differences to figure out whom they should despise. All it takes is that European Americans have light skin and African Americans have dark skin, that Hindus make a point of not eating beef and Muslims make a point of not eating pork, or in the Dr. Seuss story that the star-bellied sneeches have bellies with stars and the plain-bellied sneeches have none upon thars. Once there is more than one language, ethnocentrism can do the rest. We need to understand why there is more than one language. Darwin himself expressed the key insight. The formation of different languages and of distinct species and the proofs that both have been developed through a gradual process are curiously parallel. We find in distinct languages striking homologies due to community of descent and analogies due to a similar process of formation. Languages, like organic beings, can be classed in groups under groups, and they can be classed either naturally, according to descent, or artificially by other characters. Dominant languages and dialects spread widely and lead to the gradual extinction of other tongues. A language, like a species, when extinct, never reappears. That is, English is similar, though not identical, to German for the same reason that foxes are similar, though not identical, to wolves. English and German are modifications of a common ancestor language spoken in the past, and foxes and wolves are modifications of a common ancestor species that lived in the past. Indeed, Darwin claimed to have taken some of his ideas about biological evolution from the linguistics of his time, which we will encounter later in this chapter. Differences among languages, like differences among species, are the effects of three processes acting over long spans of time. One process is variation, mutation in the case of species, linguistic innovation in the case of languages. The second is heredity, so the descendants resemble their progenitors in these variations, genetic inheritance in the case of species, the ability to learn in the case of languages. The third is isolation, by geography, breeding season, or reproductive anatomy in the case of species, by migration